After the concert, he'd buy me a pastry. We'd sit together at a place nearby, and when I was a bit older, we'd head out afterward and have dinner. But he never spoke about his time as a pianist. And besides, my mind was altogether elsewhere in those years. Sunday evenings were always reserved for last-minute homework. So coming here with him meant I'd have to stay up doing work I could have finished much earlier. But I was glad to be with him, more than I liked the music. And as you see, I'm still bound by routine. I've spoken too much, haven't I? Do you play? I asked, to let him know that I didn't mind his talking. Not really. I followed in my father's footsteps. He was a lawyer, his father was a lawyer, I became a lawyer. Neither my father nor I wanted to be lawyers, and yet life, he smiled wistfully. It was the second time that he'd smiled and then shrugged his shoulders. His was a broad, endearing, and sudden smile that caught you off guard. But given the irony underscoring the word life, there was little mirth in it. And which instrument do you play? He said, suddenly turning to me. I didn't want our conversation to end and was surprised to sense he didn't want it to either. Piano, I answered. Vocation or avocation? Vocation, I hope. He seemed to think for a while. Don't give up, young man. Don't. So saying, he put a wise, gently patronizing arm around my shoulder. I don't know why, but I reached for the hand that had rested on my shoulder and touched it. It had happened so seamlessly that I looked at him and we both smiled, which allowed his hand, which would most likely have left the spot, to stay just a moment longer. He turned, but then looked at me once more, and I felt a sudden urge to hurl myself against him and put my arms around his upper waist right under his jacket. He must have felt something along those lines as well, because in the awkward silence that followed what he'd just said, he kept staring. And I was staring back, totally undaunted, until it hit me that perhaps I had read all the signals wrong. And I began to want to look away. I liked that his eyes lingered on me still. It made me feel handsome and desirable, something soft, caressing that I wanted to hold in place and didn't want to escape from, except by burrowing into his chest. I liked the promise in his gaze of something totally kind and guileless. But then, perhaps to give a hasty justification to our smiles, he said, "You come here for the music, and I come for my father. He died almost 30 years ago, yet nothing changes here," he chuckled. "Same cider, same odors, same old nuns, same stifling November evenings. Do you like November?" "Sometimes, but not always." "Me neither. I don't even like church. Though perhaps I like to come here on evenings like this, and, well, me voici, here I am." I could sense he was running out of things to say and was fumbling to keep our conversation going. Then silence. Again, the warm, fetching smile, a blend of wisdom, irony, and just a dab of sadness to remind me that there was nothing light about this gentle, possibly unhappy man. When we saw the quartet shuffle back to their places and that it was time for the Beethoven, he asked where I was sitting. I didn't understand why he was asking, but I pointed to the corner seat in one of the last pews where I'd left my backpack and jacket. "Chosen wisely," he understood why. "But don't slip away," he added. I thought he was asking me to give the quartet another chance before opting for a hasty exit, but I had already changed my mind after the Haydn and had no intention of leaving before the end of the concert. But then to clear the air, I asked point blank, "Do you want me to wait for you?" The inflection in my voice could have been all wrong. I sounded as though I were asking an older person if he'd need someone to hold the door for him while he struggled with his walker. So I repeated, "I'll wait for you outside." He didn't say anything. He simply nodded. But his wasn't a nod of affirmation, meaning yes. It was the pensive, distracted, wistful nod of someone who normally chooses not to believe a word he's heard. Yes, why not wait for me, he finally said, and my name is Michel. I told him my name. We shook hands. I was sure he was going to leave at the end of the first movement, but half an hour later we met on the steps of the church, just as we'd promised, except that I had a feeling he'd forgotten about our meeting. He was speaking with a couple, and all three seemed about to head out somewhere, but as soon as he saw me, he turned around and hastily finished talking to them as they shook hands goodbye. He apologized for not introducing me. I was busy wrapping my scarf around my neck, which was my way of deflecting his apology. I caught myself trying to seem surprised he had waited, or that he remembered we promised to meet. Or had he perhaps waited simply to say goodbye once more before we went our separate ways? Instead, he suggested we go for a little something at a small bistro not too far across the bridge. I told him I had locked my folding bike nearby. Did he mind if I unlocked it and walked with it? Not at all. It was around 10 on a Sunday evening, and the streets were largely empty. And you are my guest, he added, to reassure me that money should not be a concern. I accepted. I liked the walk, especially as it had rained during the concert and the cobblestones glinted under the streetlights. Just like a Brassai photo, I said. Yes, isn't it? He added. And what do you do besides play the piano? I noticed that he tended to start some sentences with the word and, perhaps to smooth out the jolting or missing transition between unrelated subjects, especially when broaching something slightly more probing, more personal. I told him I taught at the conservatory. Did I like teaching? Very much. Then I said that once a week I also play gratis and for the fun of it at a piano bar in a luxury hotel. He didn't ask the name of the hotel. Tactful, I thought, or just his way of showing he wasn't the sort who prods or cares. When we arrived at the bridge, we spotted two Brazilian performers, a man and a woman, singing to a large group who'd gathered around them. The man's voice was high, the woman's raucous. Together they sang beautifully. I stopped walking the bike and stood a moment, one hand holding the handlebar. He stood there as well, holding the other end of the handlebar as if he were helping me steady the bike. I could tell he felt slightly awkward. When the young singers ended their song, everyone on the bridge clapped and cheered, while the two singers immediately launched into another duet. I wanted to hear part of the second song and wasn't budging, but soon after they had begun singing, we decided to walk away and, once on the opposite bank, heard the crowd clapping when the singers were done. He saw me turn around, then turned himself to watch the male singer put down his guitar while she began sauntering through the crowd, cap in hand. Did I recognize the song? He asked. Yes, I said. Did he? Maybe, I think so. But I could tell he had no idea, just as he seemed out of his element listening to Brazilian music played on a bridge, of all places. It's about a man who comes back home from work and asks his beloved to get dressed and come outside and dance with him. There is such an eruption of joy on their street that eventually the whole city bursts with joy. Nice song, he said. I wanted him to feel less ill at ease, and for a few seconds clasped his shoulder. But he was totally at home once he opened the door to his bistro. The place was indeed small, just as he had said, but it also looked very exclusive. I should have known. His navy forestiere jacket, the large flowing printed scarf, and the Corte shoes were dead giveaways. Our little snack turned out to be a three-course dinner. He ordered a single malt. Kalila was his favorite, he said. He asked if I wanted one. I said yes, but had no idea what a single malt was. I could tell he'd seen through this, perhaps had seen it many times. I liked his manner, but it left me feeling uneasy. He explained the menu. Not too many meats here, he said, but their wine cellar is good, and I like how they cook vegetables. Fish is also very good. He shut the menu no sooner than he'd opened it. I always ordered the same thing, so I don't even bother to look. He waited for me to decide what I wanted. I couldn't decide. Then I did something that came to me totally impulsively. Order for me, I said. I loved the idea, and it seemed he loved it too. Easily done. I'll order what I always have for you too. He called the waiter and ordered. Then, after sipping from his whiskey, he said that his father, who had introduced him to this restaurant, was also in the habit of ordering the same thing all the time. He was diabetic, he explained, so I learned to avoid what diabetics shouldn't eat. No sugars, no rice, no pasta, no bread, and seldom any butter. As he said that, he was buttering and then sprinkling salt on the end of his small pampoulan roll, snickering as he brought it to his mouth. I don't always walk in my father's footsteps, but his shadow is difficult to avoid. I am full of contradictions. There was a pause. He went on about his father's regimen, but I wanted to hear more about his contradictions, which interested me, and which might have told me more about who this man was and how he saw himself. He seemed to waver between opening up and going on about food and dieting. There was even a moment of slight tension, as though we both sensed we were just making conversation and could easily get trapped in small talk. To get past the awkwardness, I told him about my two great uncles, whom I'd never met but who had the reputation of being very savvy bakers, and who had opened three bakeries in Milan only to be rounded up as socialists during the war. They ended up in Birkenau. My mother frequently spoke about her uncles when I was growing up. They too, as in your father's case, cast long shadows on my mother's family. What kind of shadows? He asked, not quite getting my point. She bakes wonderful cakes. He gave a hearty laugh. I was glad he got the joke. But I know some shadows never go away, I added. You're right, my father's shadow never left me. He died 2 years after I inherited his law practice. I was your age at the time. But then he stopped short again and thought a while, as though he had seized an unforeseen link between what he just said and what, without my knowing, must have been pressing on his mind. And you know that I'm almost twice your age. This was when I blushed. It was a tense and awkward moment, partly because he had broached a subject that felt totally premature and too close to what we were cautiously sidestepping, crossing T's that weren't even written out yet, and should have remained silent at least for a while longer. But his statement also left me feeling at a loss for what to say, and as I rummaged for just the right words, the blush must have signaled my discomfort. Perhaps it was his way of bringing the subject out into the open and making me say something to allay his own anxieties. I struggled to banish our silence, but couldn't. Finally, "You don't show your age at all," I said, my attempt at an evasive response. "That is not what I meant," was his quick comeback. "I know what you meant. And to show there was no misunderstanding between us, I wouldn't be sitting here with you, would I?" Was I blushing again? I hope not. The silence that suddenly hovered between us did not displease him, and he nodded again, that same wistful and reflective nod, followed by a very mild shaking of the head, not a negation, but of something bordering on disbelief and speechless wonderment at the way life simply plays along sometimes. "I didn't mean to make things awkward for you," he was apologizing. Or maybe not. It was my turn to shake my head. "No awkwardness at all," I said. Then after a short pause, and now you're the one blushing. He pursed his lips. I reached for his hand across the table and held it for a moment in a friendly gesture, hoping he wouldn't feel uneasy. He didn't withdraw it. You don't believe in fate, do you? He asked. I don't know, I said. I've never really thought about it. It was the kind of talk that was not as oblique as I would have wished. I could sense where he was headed, and I didn't mind the candor, but I didn't need the matter discussed too broadly either. Perhaps he belonged to a generation that sought out what was a tad difficult to discuss. I, to one, where what's obvious enough is left unstated. I was used to the totally direct approach that requires no words whatsoever, or just a glance, or a hasty text. But shrouded, lingering speech left me unmoored. So if it wasn't fate, what brought you to the concert tonight? He gave my question some thought. Then, looking down and away from me, started drawing ridges on the tablecloth with the fork he hadn't yet used. They looked like light furrows that made sudden squiggly turns around his bread plate. He was so taken by what had crossed his mind that I was sure he was no longer focusing on my question, which I welcomed, since on second thought I hoped he'd let go of our gingerly back and forth. But then he looked up at me and said that the answer to my question couldn't be simpler. What is it? I asked, knowing he'd say something about his father. Instead, he said, You. Me? He nodded. Yes, you. But you didn't know you'd meet me. A meaningless detail. Fate works forward, backward, crisscrosses sideways, and couldn't care less how we scan its purposes with our rickety little befores and afters. I took this in. Too deep for me. There was another moment of silence between us. You see, my father believed in fate. He went on. What a generous soul, I thought. He had sensed I'd wanted to skirt the subject and had deftly brought the conversation back to his father. But I wasn't really listening. He could tell I wasn't. Then he stopped. He was probably still debating how to broach the unspoken between us, which explains why he cast a lingering glance at me, then looked away. What totally surprised me, though, was what he said next as we stood up from our table and were about to leave. Will I see you again? I would like to. His question startled me. I muttered a feeble but all too hasty, yes, of course. My reply came so quickly that it must have sounded totally disingenuous. I had expected something far bolder than a goodbye from him. But only if you want to, he added. I stared at him. You know I'd like to. And this wasn't the single malt or the wine speaking. He nodded his signature nod. He was not convinced, but not displeased. Same church, same time next Sunday, then. I did not venture to add anything more. So tonight was not in the cards, I thought. We were the very last to leave the restaurant. It was clear from the way the waiters were hovering that they were eager to close down the moment we stepped outside. On the sidewalk, we instinctively embraced. But it was a makeshift, clumsy hug that was more of a holding back than the prolonged cuddle I had hoped to find in his arms earlier on when we'd met during intermission. He was already softening his hold. Once again, I felt an impulse to throw myself against him and put my arms around him, and though I held back in the flurry of the moment, I ended up kissing him not on the cheek, but without meaning to, under both his ears. Definitely the single malt and the wine this time. I am sure he must have noticed, but I liked what I'd done. Then I thought twice about it. This was awkward, I thought. More awkward yet when I spotted the three waiters staring out the window from behind the parted muslin shears. They knew him well and must have witnessed similar scenes many times before. He walked me to where I locked my bicycle, watched me unlock it, started a bit of small talk about the diminutive size of the bike, Even said he'd thought of purchasing one just like it. But then, before withdrawing, he placed a lingering palm on my cheek, a gesture that completely threw me off and left me feeling shaken and overcome with emotion. He had caught me by surprise. I wanted us to kiss. Just kiss me, will you? If only to help me get over being so visibly flustered. I watched him pivot and walk away. You don't do that and walk away, I thought. And so stiffly, too. I wanted him to bring his other palm to my cheek and hold my face and let me be the younger of the two, and then kiss me deep in the mouth. It felt as though we'd just been in bed together and he'd stopped talking to me and then simply vanished. The feeling stayed with me all night, and I kept waking in fits and starts. The night was still young, and we could easily have gone elsewhere for another drink. I could have rushed after him and asked to offer him something at a cafe nearby just to be together and not say goodbye so soon. Yet something held me back, and eventually another voice in me reminded me that I was not exactly displeased by how the evening had turned out on the end of a long, dull Sunday when nothing remotely like this was planned. Perhaps he'd seen that sometimes it's best to stop things when they're perfect, rather than race on and watch them sour. I walked my bike on this lovely November night. The deserted, glinting cobblestones, the Brassailles effect we'd discussed. My clumsy kiss under his ears, and the matter about being almost half his age. All these buoyed my spirit and made me feel quite happy. Perhaps he'd understood things better than I ever could. And if he'd understood, then he knew something I was barely beginning to realize myself. That perhaps I wasn't ready any more than he was. Not tonight, not tomorrow night, not even next week. Which was when it finally dawned on me that he might not attend next Sunday's concert, not because he didn't want to, but because he already sensed that at the last minute next Sunday evening, I'd be the one who'd find a reason not to show up. Two evenings later, I was just finishing a masterclass devoted to the last movement of Beethoven's D minor sonata, when suddenly, at the door, there he was, standing with his hands in his pockets of his blue blazer, looking a touch gawky for such an elegant man, and yet not in the slightest bit uncomfortable. He held the door for the six or seven who were starting to leave the hall, and seeing they were filing out without holding the door or thanking him, he smiled broadly at them, finally thanking them for the tip. I must have been beaming. What a lovely way to surprise someone. You're not displeased, then? I shook my head, like you needed to ask. What were you planning after class? I usually have coffee or a juice somewhere. Mind if I join?
Mind if I join? I mimicked.
I took him to my favorite cafe where I go after teaching and where sometimes a colleague or a student joins me as we sit and watch people race along the sidewalks at this time of day. People on last-minute errands, others looking to put off heading home and shutting their door to the world. And then some just rushing from one corner of their lives to another. The tables around us were all filled with people, and for some reason that I've never been able to define, I like when everyone seems bunched together, almost elbow to elbow with strangers. Are you really not displeased I came then? He asked again. I smiled and shook my head. I told him I was still not recovered from the surprise. Good surprise, then? Very good surprise. If I didn't find you at the conservatory, he said, I was going to try every luxury hotel with a piano bar. Very simple. It would have taken you a long time. I gave myself 40 days and 40 nights, and then I would have tried the conservatory. Instead, I tried the conservatory first. Weren't we planning on meeting this coming Sunday? I wasn't too sure that I didn't object or say anything to gainsay his assumption must have confirmed his suspicion. Indeed, our silence regarding next Sunday's concert made us smile uneasily. I have wonderful memories of last Sunday, I ended up saying.
So do I, he replied.
Who was the lovely pianist with whom you were playing? He asked.
She's a very talented third-year student from Thailand, very, very gifted.
The way you looked at each other while playing clearly suggests there is more than just teacher-pupil affinity between you.
Yes, she came all the way here to study with me.
I could tell where he was leading and shook my head with mock reproof at the insinuation.
And may I ask what you're doing later?
Bold, I thought.
You mean tonight?
Nothing.
Doesn't someone like you have a friend, a partner, someone special?
Someone like me?
Are we really going to repeat last Sunday's conversation?
I meant young, sparkling, clearly fascinating, to say nothing of very handsome.
There is no one, I said, then looked away. Was I really trying to cut him off? Or was I enjoying this without wanting to show it?
You don't take compliments well, do you?
I looked at him and shook my head again, but without humor this time.
So no one? He finally asked.
Nobody.
Not even the occasional?
I don't do the occasional.
Never? He asked, almost baffled.
Never. But I could hear my tone stiffen. He was trying to be playful, prodding, borderline flirtatious, and here I was coming off as mirthless, dour, and worst of all, self-righteous. But there must have been someone special.
There was.
Why did it end?
We were friends, then we were lovers, then she split. But we stayed friends.
Was there ever a he in your life?
Yes.
How did it end?
He got married.
Ah, the marriage canard.
I thought so too at the time. But they've been together for years now. They were together before he started with me.
At first he didn't say anything, but he seemed to question the whole setup.
Did the two of you remain friends?
I wasn't sure I wanted him to ask, yet I loved being asked.
We haven't spoken in ages, and I don't know that we're friends, though I'm sure we will always be.
He's always read me extremely well, and I have a feeling that he suspects that if I never write, it's not because I don't care, but because a part of me still does and always will, just as I know he still cares, which is why he too never writes. And knowing this is good enough for me,
even though he's the one that got married.
Even though he's the one who got married, I echoed. And besides, I added, as though it dispelled any ambiguity, he teaches in the U.S. and I'm here in Paris. Kind of settles it, doesn't it?
Unseen, but always there.
Doesn't settle it at all.
Why haven't you gone after him, even if he is married? Why give up so easily?
The near critical tone in his voice was hard to miss. Why was he reproaching me? Was he not interested then?
Besides, how long ago was it? He asked.
I knew my answer would leave him totally stumped.
15 years?
Suddenly he stopped asking and went silent. As I expected, he had not figured that so many years could go by and leave me still attached to someone who had become an invisible presence.
It belongs to the past, I said, trying to make amends.
Nothing belongs to the past.
But then he right away asked,
you still think of him, don't you?
I nodded because I did not want to say yes.
Do you miss him?
When I'm alone, sometimes, yes. But it doesn't intrude, doesn't make me sad.
I can go entire weeks without thinking of him. Sometimes I want to tell him things, but then I put it off. And even telling myself that I'm putting it off gives me some pleasure, though we may never speak.
He taught me everything.
My father said there were no taboos in bed.
My lover helped me cast them off. He was my first.
Michel shook his head with a confiding smile that reassured me.
How many after him? He asked.
Not many, all short-lived, men and women.
Why?
Maybe because I never really let go or lose myself with others. After an instant of passion, I always fall back to being the autonomous me. He took a last sip of his coffee. At some point in your life, you will need to call him. The moment will come. It always does. But perhaps I shouldn't be saying all this.
Why?
I asked. Oh, you know why. I liked what he'd just said, but it left us both silent. The autonomous you, then, he finally said, obviously eliding what had just transpired between us that very second. Difficult, aren't you? My father used to say so as well, because I could never decide on anything. What to do in life, where to live, what to study, whom to love. Stick to music, he said. Sooner or later, the rest would come. He started his career at the age of 32, so I still have some time, though not much if I'm to time myself to his clock. We've been exceptionally close ever since I was a baby. He was a philologist and writing his dissertation at home while my mother was a therapist in a hospital, so he was the one in charge of diapers and all the rest. We had help, but I was always with him. He's the one who taught me to love music. Ironically, the very same piece I was teaching when you walked in this afternoon. When I teach it, I still hear his voice. My father, too, taught me music. I was just a bad student. I liked this sudden convergence of coincidences, though I was reluctant to make too much of it either. He kept staring at me without saying anything. But then he said something that caught me off guard once again. You are so handsome. It had come totally unprompted, so that rather than react to his words, I tried to change the subject, except that in doing so, I heard myself mutter something more unprompted yet. You make me nervous.
What makes you say that?
I don't know, maybe because I don't really know what you're after or where you'd want me to stop and not go further.
Should be very clear by now. If anything, I'm the one who should be nervous.
Why?
Because I'm probably just a whim for you. Or maybe a few rungs higher than an occasional. I scoffed at this. And by the way, I hesitated before saying it, but felt impelled to say it. I'm not very good at beginnings.
He chuckled. Was this thrown in for my benefit?
Maybe.
Well, but to come back to what I was saying, you are unbelievably handsome. And the problem is either that you know it and are aware of its power over others, or that you need to pretend not to, which makes you not just difficult to decipher, but for someone like me, dangerous. All I did was nod, listlessly. I didn't want him to feel that what he'd just told me was misplaced. So I stared at him, smiled, and in another setting would have touched his eyelids before kissing them both. As it got darker, the lights of our cafe and of the adjoining one were lit. They cast a luminous, unsteady glow on his features, and for the first time, I was aware of his lips, his forehead, and his eyes. He's the handsome one, I thought. I should have said so, and the moment was ripe for it, but I kept quiet. I did not want to echo his own words. It would have sounded like a strained and contrived attempt to establish parity between us. But I did love his eyes, and he was still staring at me.
You remind me of my son, he finally said.
Do we look alike?
No, but you're the same age. He too loves classical music, so I used to take him to the Sunday evening concerts the way my father had so often done with me.
Do you still go together?
No, he lives in Sweden, mostly.
But the two of you are close?
I wish. My divorce with his mother ruined things between us, though I'm sure she did nothing to hurt our relationship. But he knew about me, of course, and I suppose never forgave me. Or he used it as an excuse to turn against me, which he'd been wanting to do since his early 20s, God knows why. How did they find out? She did first. One early evening she walked in and found me listening to slow jazz and nursing a drink. I was alone, and just by watching me and the look on my face, she knew right away that I was in love. Classic feminine intuition. She put down her handbag by the coffee table, sat next to me on the sofa, and even reached out and had a sip of my drink. "Is she someone I know?" she asked, after a long, long silence. I knew exactly what she meant, and there was no point denying it. "It's not a she," I replied. "Ah," she said. I still remember the last remnants of sunlight on the carpet and against the furniture, the smoky smell of my whiskey and the cat lying next to me. Sunlight, when I see it in my living room, still reminds me of that conversation. "So it's worse than I thought," she said. "Why?" I asked. "Because against a woman, I still stand a chance. But against who you are, there's nothing I can do. I cannot change you." Thus ended almost 20 years of marriage. My son was bound to find out soon enough, and he did.
"How?"
I told him. I was under the illusion that he'd understand. He didn't. "I'm sorry," was all I could say. He shrugged his shoulders. "I don't regret the turn in my life, but I do regret losing him. He never calls when he is in Paris, seldom even writes, and doesn't pick up when I call." He looked at his watch. Was it time to go already? "So it's not a mistake that I tracked you down?" He asked for the third time, perhaps because he loved hearing me say that it absolutely wasn't, which I enjoyed telling him. "Not a mistake." "And you weren't upset with me about the other evening?" he asked. I knew exactly what he was referring to.
"Maybe I was. A bit."
He smiled. I could tell he was eager to leave the cafe, so I moved closer to him, my shoulder touching his, which was when he put his arm around me and drew me to him, almost urging me to rest my head on his shoulder. I didn't know whether this was meant to reassure me or simply humor a young man who had opened up and spoken some touching words to an older man. Perhaps it was the prelude to a goodbye hug. So, fearing the unavoidable leave-taking, I blurted out, "I'm not doing anything tonight." "Yes, I know. You told me." But he must have sensed that I was nervous or that his tone was off. "You are an amazing," and he didn't finish his sentence. He was about to pay, but I stopped his hand. Then, as I held it, I stared at it. "What are you doing?" he asked almost reproachfully.
"Paying."
"No, you were staring at my hand."
"I wasn't," I protested, but I had stared at his hand.
"It's called age," he said. Then a moment later, "Haven't changed your mind, have you?" He bit his lower lip, but then right away released it. He was waiting for my answer. And then because there was nothing I could think of saying to him, but still felt the need to say something, anything, "Let's not say goodbye. Not just yet." But I realized that this could easily be viewed as a request to extend our time together by a short while in the cafe, so I decided to opt for something bolder.
"Don't let me go home tonight, Michel," I said.
I know I blushed saying this, and was already scrambling for ways to apologize and take back my words when he came to my rescue. I was struggling to ask the very same thing, but once again, you beat me to it. "The truth is," he went on, "I don't do this frequently. Actually, I haven't done this in a long time." "This," I said, with a light jeer in my voice. This. We left shortly after. We must have walked with my bike a good 20 or 30 minutes to his home. He offered to hail a taxi. I said no, that I preferred to walk. Besides, the bike was not the easiest thing to fold, and taxi drivers always complained. I love your bike. I love that you have such a bike. Then, catching himself, I'm speaking nonsense, aren't I? We were walking side by side with hardly a foot's distance between us, and our hands kept grazing. Then I reached for his and held it for a few moments. This would break the ice, I thought. But he kept quiet. A few more paces on the cobbled street, and I let go of his hand. I do love this, I said. This? He teased. Meaning the Brassai effect? He asked. No, me and you. It's what we should have done 2 nights ago. He looked down at the sidewalk, smiling. Was I perhaps rushing things? I liked how our walk tonight was a repeat of the other evening. The crowd and the singing on the bridge, the glinting slate cobbles, the bike with its strapped bag I would eventually lock to a pole, and his passing comment about wishing to buy one just like it, but never ceased to amaze me and cast a halo around our evening was that ever since we'd met, we'd been thinking along the same lines. And when we feared we weren't or felt we were wrong-footing each other, it was simply because we had learned not to trust that anyone could possibly think and behave the way we did. Which was why I was so diffident with him and mistrusted every impulse in myself and couldn't have been happier when I saw how easily we'd shed some of our screens. How wonderful to have finally said exactly what was on my mind ever since Sunday. Don't let me go home tonight. How wonderful that he'd seen through my blushing on Sunday night and made me want to admit I'd blushed, only then to concede that he himself had blushed as well. Could two people who'd basically spent less than 4 hours together still have so few secrets from each other? I wondered what the guilty secret was that I held in my vault of craven falsehoods. I lied about the occasionals, I said. I figured as much, he replied, almost discounting the struggle behind my avowal. When we finally stepped into one of those tight, small Parisian elevators with no space between us. Now will you hold me? I asked. He shut the slim elevator doors and pressed the button to his floor. I heard the loud clank of the engine and the strain as the elevator began its ascent, when suddenly he didn't just hold me, but cupped my face in both his hands and kissed me deep on the mouth. I shut my eyes and kissed him back. I'd been waiting for this for such a long time. All I remember hearing was the sound of the very old elevator grinding and staggering its way up to his floor, as I kept hoping the sound would never end and the elevator never stop. Then, once he closed the door to his apartment, it was my turn to kiss him, just as he had kissed me. I knew he was taller, and I sensed he was stronger. I just wanted him to know that I was holding nothing back and wasn't going to. Perhaps what we need is a good drink, he said. I have some wonderful single malts. It is single malts you like, correct? The question about drinks caught me totally off guard, especially as I was just about to drop my backpack and remove my coat and sweater and ask him to hold me again. My heart was racing. But suddenly I felt awkward, even if none of this was unfamiliar to me. I kept wanting him to stop moving around so much, but I said nothing, took my time removing my backpack and placing it on an armchair. Do you want to remove your coat? He asked. In a while, I said. I like your backpack, he said, turning around. It was a gift, a friend. And because there was hesitation on his face, just a friend. He pointed to the sofa for me to sit and said he was bringing in the glasses. so I sat down. I don't know why, but I suddenly felt cold, so I stood up again while he was in the foyer and leaned against the radiator. Feeling the warmth inadequate, I placed my arms against it as well. Are you feeling all right? Yes, just cold, I said. I was almost not going to tell him that I was suddenly close to freezing. I'll shut the window then. And he did. Did I want ice in my whiskey? I shook my head. But I didn't move away from the radiator and continued to keep both hands and the front of my body glued to it. He put down the glasses on the coffee table, approached me from behind, and began massaging my shoulders. I love the way he kneaded my neck and shoulder blades. Better? He asked. More, I said. Then without knowing why, I told you I get nervous. Because of me, I hunched my shoulders, knowing he'd understand I meant, I don't know, maybe it's not you or the evening, who knows, just don't stop. He had strong hands, and he knew, just as I wanted him to know, that I was yielding bit by bit each time he pressed the area right under my skull and sent the most stirring shudder all the way down my spine. When he was done, he put his arms around me and pressed his chest to my back, both his hands clasping my stomach. I wouldn't have minded had he gone lower, but he didn't, though I knew it had crossed his mind because I sensed a millisecond of hesitation. Gently, he drew me to the sofa, but then he started with the whiskey, poured some into both our glasses, suddenly remembered something and rushed to the kitchen, coming back with two bowls, one with nuts, the other with mini salted biscuits. He sat down at the other end of the sofa. We clinked our glasses, uttered a toast, and took our first sip. He wanted to know what I thought. I didn't know what I thought. So I said I was still quite new to single malts, but that I liked them. He offered the bowl of nuts, watched me take some, then placed it back on the coffee table without helping himself to any. I took a second sip and told him that I was still cold. Could I have a cup of tea instead? What kind of tea did I want? He had so many, he said. Any tea, I replied, just something hot. On his way to the kitchen, he touched my cheek and the side of my neck. It reminded me of my mother when I wasn't feeling well and she'd checked to see if I had a fever. But his was not a fever touch. And I smiled. Within minutes, immediately following the beep of the microwave oven, he was back and I was cupping a warm mug in both hands. So much better, I said, almost laughing at how happy the tea made me feel. Once again, he stood up and put on some music. I listened for a moment. Brazilian? Correct. He seemed very pleased with himself. He had bought the CD the day before, he said. By my smile, he knew I'd inferred the reason for the purchase. Did I understand Portuguese? He asked. Some, did he? Not a word. It made us laugh. We were both nervous. We talked mostly about old partners. His had been an architect who eventually moved to Montreal years ago. Yours? He asked. And I don't mean the marriage canard. So he did remember the man who'd got away and thrown my life off course. I told him that my longest relationship was with a kid I'd known in elementary school, whom I'd met almost 15 years later in a gay bar on the seedy outskirts of Rome. What astounded me was that he confessed to having a crush on me when we were 8. I told him I'd been totally fascinated by him when I was 9. Why hadn't he said anything? Why hadn't I? I hadn't either of us known about ourselves. All we wanted to do was make up for lost time. I think we could not believe how lucky we were to have reconnected. How long were you together?
Less than 2 years.
Why did you separate?
I used to think it was good old ordinary domesticity that killed what we had, but it was more than that. He wanted to adopt a child. He even wanted me to father the child. What he wanted was a family.
And you didn't?
I don't know that I didn't. I just knew that I wasn't ready. I was entirely devoted to music and still am. The real truth is I couldn't wait to live alone again. He gave me a quizzical look.
Is this by any chance meant as a warning to me? He asked.
I don't know. I smiled to cover up my embarrassment. His question was totally premature, but then, in his place, I would have asked the same thing.
Perhaps I shouldn't have said anything, but I'm looking at all this from the other end. Age. I'm sure it's crossed your mind more than once.
Age is no problem.
Isn't it?
I told you so on Sunday. How quickly we forget.
I don't remember.
You're losing your memory.
I was flustered.
And I wasn't?
I've thought of you ever since we said goodnight outside the brasserie. I went to bed thinking of you, woke up thinking of you, and was in a trance all of Monday, basically kicking myself. I can't even bring myself to believe you're sitting under my roof.
He stopped speaking, looked at me, and just said,
"And I want to kiss you."
I was more surprised this time than when we kissed on stepping into the elevator. It made me feel we had never kissed before, and that the shadow of uneasiness while walking home with him without being able to hold hands had not been dispelled. He put down his glass, moved over to me, and kissed me lightly on the lips, almost diffidently, while, like the obliging soundtrack to our earlier kiss, I kept hearing behind the faint Brazilian singer playing in our room the sound of the elevator coming down to remind me that kissing to the sound of an old elevator going up and down the stairwell was like kissing under the patter of falling rain on a rooftop in the country, and that I liked the sound and didn't want it to end because I felt snug, protected, and safe under its spell. Because without intruding on us, it gave a voice to the world outside his living room and reminded me that all this was not just happening in my mind. What he was really asking, perhaps, was for us to take our time and not hurry, and if need be, backtrack if things went faster than either of us wanted. This I had never done before. Then he kissed me a second time. Also lightly.
Feeling better? He asked.
Much. Just hold me again, please. I wanted to be held and to wrap my arms around him. I liked the texture of his sweater on my face, the smell of wool, and behind the wool, around his underarms, a faint scent that could only have been his body's. So I whispered the words of the song in Portuguese. Se que servir o mapa, se o fim está traçado. Se que servir a terra vista, se o barco está parado. Se que servir a chave, se a porta está aberta.
Translate, he said.
What good is the map if the end's already known? What good is landfall if the boat stalls? What good is a key if the door's wide open? He loved this, he said, and asked me to repeat the words, which I did. Soon he said, "Let's lie down." He showed me to the bedroom. I was about to unbutton my shirt, but "Don't," he said, "let me do it." I wanted to be naked before him, but didn't know how to say this. So I let him unbutton my shirt without touching any of his clothing.
he didn't seem to mind. It's because, and he hesitated. I want this to be very special, he said. And as we lay down, we embraced and sought each other's mouths. But I could sense we were still unsteady and off balance. Something was missing. It was not passion we lacked, it was conviction. Had we, perhaps, slowed things down to a halt? Had I failed him? Were we changing our minds? He must have felt it as well. It's something no one can conceal or fail to pick up. He stared at me, and all he said was, "Will you let me make you happy? Just let me. I so want to." "Do anything you want. You make me happy as it is." Hearing this, he could not wait, and kissed me again, and began to finish unbuttoning my shirt. "Mind if I take your shirt off?" "What a question," I thought as I nodded. Then as he helped me, "I love your skin. I love your chest, your shoulders, your smell. Are you still cold?" he asked, all the while gently caressing my chest. "No," I said, "not any longer." Then once again he surprised me. "I'd love us to take a hot shower." I must have looked at him with totally baffled eyes. "Why not, if you want to?" We stood up and stepped into his bathroom. It was larger than my entire living room. I couldn't believe the number of bottles lining the floor of his large, enclosed glass shower. "Two for you, two for me," he said, producing four folded navy towels. In an effort to bring some humor to the situation as we were getting undressed and already touching, I asked if they served breakfast here in the morning. "And how?" he replied. "A complimentary breakfast is included for all hotel guests." We were naked and hard when we kissed again. "Shut your eyes and trust me," he said. "I want to make you happy." I didn't know what he was up to, but I did as he asked. I heard him grab a cloth, and I immediately recognized the scent of the shower gel because it smelled of chamomile, which reminded me of my parents' home, and despite the weather outside tonight, it took me right back to our summers in Italy, which made me feel at home in this home that wasn't my home. He began to rub my body, and I let myself go with the feeling. "Don't open your eyes," he cautioned, as he palmed my face gently with soap, and then asked if he could shampoo my hair, to which I said of course he could. And while the shampoo sat on my hair after he'd rubbed it in, I heard him wash himself, only then to feel his fingers rubbing and prodding my skull time and time again. "Don't cheat and look," he said. And I could tell from his voice that he was smiling, almost laughing at what the two of us were doing in the shower. After the shower, and while my eyes were still shut, he opened the glass door and helped me step out slowly, then insisted on drying my body, my hair, my back, and underarms, and then walked me to the bedroom and asked me to lie on his bed. I loved knowing I was naked and being stared at. Loved being coddled this way. Loved when he started rubbing a lotion on me that felt wonderful each time he poured more of it on his palm and touched me everywhere. I felt like a toddler being washed and dried by his parent, which also took me back to my very earliest childhood when my father would shower with me in his arms. I must have been one or so. Why was all this coming to me now? And why did it suddenly release me from a box whose lid had been depriving me of air and of light and sound and of the scent of flowers and herbs in the summertime? Why was I being pulled out of myself as though I'd been a prisoner whose jailer happened to be none other than myself and me alone? And what was this product that I'd never felt on my skin before? What did I want from this man, and what was I going to give him in return? Was he doing all this because I told him I was nervous, because I'd warned him I found beginnings difficult? I let him do as he pleased, because I liked it so much, and felt so desirable that I desired him even more in return. More than I'd done the moment I'd seen him in church and held back from embracing his chest. I thought I knew what he was about to do, but what he did next once again came as a complete surprise, so that when he finally asked me to open my eyes and look straight into his, I was entirely all his. And when he kissed me again and again, I didn't need to say or think of anything. I didn't need to do a thing, except give myself over to someone who seemed to know me and know my body and what it craved far better than I did, because he must have known at the moment he'd spoken to me in church, and I'd touched his hand. Known when he'd asked me to wait for him outside the church and then invited me to dinner. Known when we stopped short of where we might have headed that night and abruptly said goodnight. Known everything about me when he saw me blush so easily and then push the matter just a tad farther to see how I'd react. Known that I'd lost my soul for so long and was now finding I'd owned it all along but didn't know where to look for it or how to find it without him. Lost my soul. Lost my soul, I wanted to say, and then heard myself mutter the words, "Lost my soul all these years." "Don't," he said, as though fearing I was on the point of tears. "Just say I'm not hurting you," he said. I nodded. "No, say you're not hurting me. Say it because you mean it." "You're not hurting me," I said. "Say it again. Say it many times." And I said, "You're not hurting me," because I meant it. "You're not hurting me. You're not hurting me. You're not. You're not." And then realized that even as I spoke these words more times than he had asked, that what he'd also done was help me leave behind everything I had brought with me that night. My thoughts, my music, my dreams, my names, my loves, my scruples, my bike. Everything was dumped on my jacket and my backpack in the living room, or stuffed into the bag that was strapped to my bike that was locked to a signpost that was all the way downstairs before we'd taken the elevator, which once again now, when we were making love, gave out its telltale squeal, because who knows which tenant in the building had pressed a button to call the elevator downstairs and would soon step inside, click shut the slim doors behind him, and ride his wobbly way to who knows which floor, and I didn't care what floor that was, because if I thought these muddled thoughts, it was because I was trying and failing each time to think that I wasn't losing my grip when I knew damn well that I was just desperately holding on to mere slivers of reality and feeling them slip from me and feeling ecstatic each time they did, because I loved that he was seeing this happen to me and I wanted him to see this on my face even when he was doing the most generous thing in the world, which was to wait and still wait. While I kept repeating he wasn't hurting me, just as he'd asked me to, until I caught myself begging him not to wait because this was the polite thing to ask, hoping he'd decide for me as well, because by now his body knew mine better than it knew itself. There'd been only a very short, awkward hiccup in what had been a moment of perfect intimacy between two men who, until then, hadn't seen each other naked. It had happened in the shower when he was holding my penis and my eyes were shut because of the soap. "I don't know how to ask this," he had said. "But," and then he hesitated again. "Yes?" He was making me nervous now and I couldn't open my eyes. "Are you Jewish?" he finally asked. "Seriously?" I replied, almost laughing. "Can't you tell?" I was trying to base my guess on other facts besides the obvious. "The obvious says it pretty loudly. How many Jews or Muslims have you seen naked?" "None," he replied. "You are my very first." His sudden candor aroused me even more, which is why I pressed his body against mine. Fabiola, he explained, right after we were jolted from sleep by the sound of the service door banging. She always lets the wind slam it shut. When I looked at my watch, it was already past 8 a.m., and I had to teach at 11, but I felt very lazy. He, however, had already released me from his embrace and was sitting up, while his feet, I thought, kept searching for his slippers. Come back to bed, I said. What more? He asked, feigning shock. I had loved being held in his arms with my back turned to him and his breath on my neck. I wasn't holding back. There had been a moment of hesitation just after we'd made love that night when I felt it was time to get dressed to leave. You're not getting out of bed, are you? He had asked. Bathroom, I said. I was lying. Not leaving, though. Not leaving. But I was lying here as well. I had meant to leave, even if I'd been doing it out of habit. I was going to explain that I always leave after sex, either because I want to or because I sense my host can't wait to see me gone. Because I myself almost always want to see occasionals out the door afterward. Hurry up with the socks. Stuff them in your pockets if you have to. Just go. I'd even mastered the art of the civil, if totally perfunctory, way of delaying my hasty exit. The way a host may sometimes feign reluctance to see you turn down a glass of water or a bite of something while you're racing out from his world, from his things, from the smell of his hair, his sheets, his towels. Here the matter was slightly odd, and I didn't say anything. I didn't really want to get out of bed. I didn't know how to read, much less trust, the look of surprise on his face. And yet, as I'd noticed from the time we were walking to his apartment and relishing how our hands kept nearing yet missing each other, this hadn't exactly been slam dunk sex either. After we made love that night, he said we should head out to grab a bite to eat. I'm starving. Me too, I echoed. But we should hurry. Neither of us had realized that it was past midnight. Do we look like we've been fucking? Yes, I said. Maybe people will know. I want them to know. So do I. We had dinner in a small but noisy place that tended to stay open late. The waiters knew him there, and some of the regulars knew him as well. It gave the two of us a shared thrill to sense they suspected what we'd been up to not 15 minutes earlier. I want one more hug, I said that morning. Just a hug. Before I knew it, I had my legs wrapped tight around his waist. And so, may I ask you something, he said, his face no more than an inch away from mine, with one palm on my forehead, brushing my hair away from my eyes. I had no idea what he had in mind. Perhaps, I figured, something to do with our bodies, or something a touch awkward about performance, or would it be about protection? Are you busy this evening? The question almost made me laugh. Totally free, I said. And how about our little bistro? What time? 9? I nodded. I had forgotten the precise address of the place. He named the street. Then, while trying not to sound too self-important, he said they sometimes kept a free table for him there. I frequently bring clients there for lunch or dinner. And others? He smiled. If you only knew. The maid must have been told he had a guest, probably while I was in the shower. Because when he showed me to the dining room, breakfast was served for two. Coffee and a host of wonderful things, breads, cheeses, and jams that seemed homemade. He said he liked quince jam and fig jam. Most people like berries and marmalades, but suit yourself. He had to rush to his office. 9 then. We left together, I told him I was going to ride home to change and then head to the conservatory, after which I had a lunch scheduled with a colleague. I don't know why I provided so much information about my day. He listened and watched me unlock the bike, admired its frame again, told me to fold it and bring it inside the next time. Then he stood there and, unlike the first time, watched as I rode away. But it was still too early in the day, so I rode down one street and then another, crossed the bridge, not caring where I was headed, eager to find a bakery where I might stop, sit, have another cup of coffee, and think of him. I didn't want the events of the morning to brush away the feeling or the memory of last night, of how we kissed savagely in the end, while all I liked hearing was the silence and the comforting wheezing of the old elevator going up and down, reminding me each time that we were no longer the last who'd used it. Usually I forget or try to put away what happened at night, which isn't difficult since things seldom last more than an hour or two. Sometimes it's as though it hadn't occurred at all, and I'm happy not to remember. Sitting down on this very clear morning, I liked watching all these people headed to work while feeling I was on an extended Christmas day. The sex had had nothing unusual about it, but I liked how he had paid attention to everything, from the moment he handed me the towels to the way he cared for my body, my pleasure, mindful of everything, and always so tactful and kind, with something verging on deference for the young body that was half his age. Even the way he kept rubbing and caressing my hand, and then my wrist, asking for trust and little else while my eyes were shut, just rubbing my wrists, which he held down gently on the bed, the kindest gesture known to man. Why had no one ever held my wrists in that way and brought me so much joy with such minute and seemingly insignificant caresses? If he forgot, I would ask him to rub my wrists just as he had done before. I put down the paper and, without thinking, had raised the collar of my fleece jacket and felt it rub my face. It reminded me of his unshaven cheek this morning, when we'd made love again. I wanted my coat to smell of him. What aftershave did he wear? It was so faint, but I wanted to know. I would learn to rub his cheek with mine tomorrow morning. And then I thought of my father, who said he'd be in Paris for Christmas in a few weeks. I wondered if Michel and I would still be together by then. I wanted my father to meet him, and wondered what he'd think of him. He and Miranda had promised to bring along the boy this time. It was time I saw my younger brother again, he said. I would take them to my cafe here, and if Michel were still a presence in my life, Miranda and I would simply sit back and watch both men figure out who was the younger of the two. I spent the rest of the day in a mild daze. Three students, plus a lecture prepared 15 minutes before class. At lunch, all I kept thinking of was dinner that night. The single malts, the nuts and salted biscuits, and the moment when he'd once again offer two towels for me and two for him. Would he be as hospitable tonight? Or would he have changed into someone I didn't know? I hoped my best shirt was well pressed, and when I checked, I found it was. I had a mind to put on a tie, but decided against it. I combed my hair, but I couldn't wait for him to brush my forehead with his hand. Then on my way out, I ran to my local cobbler to have my shoes shined. I think I'm happy. That's what I was going to say to him. I think I'm happy. I knew I should avoid saying this on our third evening, but I didn't care. I wanted to say it. When I arrived at the restaurant that night, I didn't find him and realized to my extreme embarrassment that I didn't know his surname. It left me feeling completely flustered. I would never dare say that I had come to meet Michel or Monsieur Michel.